This is The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. Thanks for joining us on this Memorial Day. And all this hour, we're going to be talking about the sacrifices and challenges that military families face, from spouses having trouble with their careers to the stress children of service members deal with. But we start the show today with someone whose family has made the ultimate sacrifice. Terry Burgess is a Gold Star father in Fort Worth, Texas. His son, Army Staff Sergeant Brian Burgess, was killed in Afghanistan on March 29, 2011.
Brian was one of the all-American boys. From a very young age, he enjoyed sports. He climbed trees. He fell out of trees. He broke bones. He teased his little sister. But he was it's hard to describe. He was the strong, silent type. He led more by example than he did with his words, and that followed him all the way into the military. And I think one of the earliest memories I have of seeing his true character was on Easter. His mother and I had already been separated, so Brian and I were at a friend's house for Easter, and the prize for the Easter egg hunt was this big, huge, cellophane-wrapped basket that had toys and prizes and candy in it. Brian won the basket. And I'm standing back here with the other moms, and they're asking, who's this kid came in, won our Easter basket? Well, you know, he's a stranger. He's not part of the family. And before they could do anything, Brian unwrapped the basket, and he stepped away from it, and he said, dig in. And he let all the other kids and some of those moms take that candy and toys out of that basket before he ever touched one piece. And that's when I knew he has a very special spirit.
Terry, this is not an easy topic, I'm sure, but tell me, how did you feel and what happened when you found out that Brian had been killed?
That is it is hard. The morning that Brian was killed, I had just had a dream about him. And in the dream, he and I were walking side by side on a rocky, dusty road, and he's talking to me, but he had no voice. So he took me around the corner. We went into this movie theater, and Brian is there on the movie screen in his combat uniform, and he's standing beside a glass coffin. And he stepped into the coffin, he lay down, and he turned into my little boy, Brian. Little boy Brian stepped out of the coffin and became Brian the Warrior again, and Brian gave me that sharp salute, and the screen just went blindingly white. And that was when I woke up. And the phone was ringing, and it was my daughter-in-law, Tiffany, telling me that Brian had been killed in Afghanistan early that morning. And all I could tell her was, I just saw him. I just dreamed about him. I just saw him. And I did not know how to process that. And then during the day, here came family. Here came the official notification from the colonel. And when the colonel told me on behalf of a grateful nation, I just broke. I just absolutely broke. I had cried at funerals of uncles and aunts and grandparents, even pets, but I had never wept like that, like I did that morning.
How did you begin to feel during those months? Like, what was the grief process like for you?
The grief process, of course, started that morning. We were flown to Dover Air Force Base for Brian's dignified transfer, where they bring our sons and daughters home for the last time. And that was where we started to see the sheer respect that the armed forces show our fallen sons and daughters. And we got to meet the families of the other soldiers that were killed that same morning as Brian. And that started a bond among the six families, and I think that helped us quite a bit. And we came to find out that Brian was actually going to be in a live-action documentary that was filmed during that battle. And when the producers of this movie called us and they said, we want you to come to Dallas to see the film, I had sunk into a really, really deep depression. So Beth got me cleaned up. She got me out of bed. And in that movie, I saw Brian on a movie screen giving a salute, talking about his children dressed in his combat uniform. And that told me right then what my mission was supposed to be. I was supposed to salute Brian back. And we traveled with this movie, the Hornet's Nest movie, across the country with the producers and the movie makers and the crew. And we got to tell Brian's story at every one of those screenings. And it was very cathartic for us. I could focus on honoring Brian more than grieving Brian.
Terry, you mentioned you became depressed. With men in particular, depression is something that sort of feels like it creeps up. Do you feel that way as a Gold Star father? Were you expecting to deal with that?
Oh, that's a good way to put it, that it creeps up on you. You know, as men, even in my generation, we're supposed to be stoic, you know, suck it up, you know, deal with it. And after we got home from Brian's funeral, you know, we were getting cards and letters and casseroles and plants. And that was good for us because we knew that other people understood our loss. But once all of that stops, it hurts almost as much as when it begins, because then you begin to think, we're forgetting Brian. We're forgetting who he was, what he did, why he died. And I think that was when my depression started setting in. I tell people that my wife, Beth, she literally had to carry two broken hearts because I just couldn't do it. I'd sit on the couch and she said that I would just sit there and stare. I wouldn't do anything. I wouldn't say anything. I'd just stare. I'd get up. I'd get a drink. I'd take pills, go to bed, and just have a real struggle getting up the next morning.
Have you noticed that among other Gold Star fathers that you know that may not be aware of what's to come emotionally and are struggling with that?
Oh, yes. Little details that we used to care about are completely insignificant now. Okay, that old Terry died that same day. He's gone. And trying to deal with with other people, with your bosses, with customers, with details, it just becomes a real struggle. And it takes a lot of concentration for dads to deal with that. And if you don't deal with it, then it becomes an anger issue. It becomes lashing out. There were days when I would sweep dishes off the table because I was just so angry. There's still a couple of holes in our walls at home that Beth won't patch up because she likes to point at them and say, you've got it under control now. This was you then. This is you now. You've got it under control. It doesn't actually get better, but it will change. And once a Gold Star dad understands that you have the chance to honor your son and daughter, you have a chance to make people aware of their story, you have a chance to make people aware of the true cost of freedom, that helps you work through that grief, through that crushing grief. There's a way through it.
Terry, what does Memorial Day mean to you today?
Memorial Day completely changed for us in March of 2011. We had celebrated Memorial Day. You know, you celebrate Veterans Day because my dad's still alive. My uncle that served, my brother that served, they were still alive. So we celebrate them on Veterans Day. And then when Memorial Day came around, I thought about my grandpa who had served in World War I. We would take a flag and a wreath and put it on the front door. You know, and then after the Memorial Day was over, then we take it down, put it back in the closet. So now Memorial Day to us is not a decoration that you take out of the closet, you dust off, and you put on the front door. Memorial Day for us is a day of remembrance, a day of honor. The tears will flow, but so will the smiles as we think about what Brian does. It's not a day to go out and buy a mattress or have a barbecue. It is a day to see what our freedom has cost us.
Do you think civilians in this country really understand the impact that military deaths can have, not just on military families, but what the fact that we are still at war and the price that some of us have had to pay for that?
There are way too many American citizens that are unaware. At Brian's funeral, we were given a Gold Star pin. The general, Brigadier General Jeff Colt, is the one that pinned it on each one of us. And he cried as he had to put that pin on us. So we wear those pins whenever we can. We'll be out in public and somebody will see that pin and they'll say, "Oh, that's pretty. How do I get one of those?" And we'll say, "You don't want one." But it's an opportunity to tell them the story, tell them why we wear that pin and what it represents. And sometimes the reaction is they'll back away. You know, like, okay, it's not contagious. I just want you to know. And then there's other times they won't say a word and they'll just give us a big hug. And that's, to us, that's a success. That's a story that's going to get retold. As you know, for a Gold Star family member, almost every day is Memorial Day. So bringing American citizens' awareness of the cost of our freedom, it's our mission. That's what we do, because so few get it.
There are people that do get it, and those people are, I guess, first and foremost, other Gold Star parents and families. On this Memorial Day, is there something you'd like to say to them?
For all the other Gold Star families, the spouses, the children, the moms, the dads, you're not alone. This is a hard, hard burden to carry. And there are so many triggers for us whenever we go shopping, whenever we hear a song, whenever we have a certain smell that reminds us of our sons and daughters whenever they were here. And on the three-day weekends we used to get to celebrate together. But you're not alone. And there are organizations that will help you carry that load. And that's the hard part, is going out and talking to other Gold Stars. We've talked to one mom, and she hadn't talked to anybody for 2 years about her son when he'd been killed. But she heard us talking and saw us, and she got up and she said, "I see and hear all of you talking about what I've been feeling for the last 2 years. So now I know it's okay to talk about my son." And that's what we need to do, share their stories.
Terry, thank you so much for sharing your story and Brian's story with us here at The Takeaway. We appreciate it.
Oh, well, thank you very, very much for this, Tanzina. Appreciate this.
Terry Burgess is the founder of Gold Star Parents Retreats and the author of When Our Blue Star Turned Gold, which he co-wrote with his wife, Beth. For the rest of the hour, we're talking about different challenges that military families face on a regular basis. We have a psychologist on how being in a military family affects children, and two military spouses share their struggles with their career path. But first, we have a story about the home in Homefront. One-third of all military families live in privatized housing. That's around 700,000 people. And private real estate companies are pulling in billions of dollars. But many of those families have found themselves living in substandard conditions.
We're talking about lead paint, mold, mice, cockroaches, falling ceiling, leaking roofs.
That's Deborah Nelson, an investigative reporter and journalism professor at the University of Maryland. Last year, she worked on a Reuters investigation that revealed deteriorating and unsanitary conditions in privatized military housing.
Members of the military expect to take risks when overseas in service of their country, but not with their families in their homes back here, yet they do.
The military says they're working on the issue, but Deborah Nelson says the stories of the families she spoke with have stayed with her.
So many families that we interviewed just had heartbreaking stories. The woman from Keesler Air Force Base, who, while deployed in Afghanistan, was more worried about her children back home because they lived in a mold-infested house and were getting sick. You know, Sharon Limon at Camp Pendleton, her family, they were among about a couple dozen Marine families that I met at Camp Pendleton who were battling infestations of rodents, bugs, mold, fungus, mushrooms growing out of the carpet. This is in housing run by Lincoln Military Housing. Lincoln's a giant real estate company. One thing that Sharon said that really stuck with me, and it's something I heard from many families, was that, you know, she and her husband had been prepared to make sacrifices for their country. What they had not expected in her case were the mice, a year-long battle with their landlord to get the problem addressed, and not just a few mice. They had dozens chewing through food containers, peeing all over the carpet. She'd pick her baby up out of the crib and find mouse feces on his leg, and the landlord, Lincoln Military, blamed her housekeeping and really made her feel bad about it. And that really wasn't unusual. What we found there and across the country is that families were being blamed for all manner of problems.
This is a disgrace, and I'm wondering who is in charge.
We had a hard time finding anybody who would take responsibility. There are about 200,000 homes on bases that have been privatized. Back 20 years ago, Congress privatized base housing because it was even in worse shape than it is now, due to years of neglect by the military. The idea, you know, is to turn over the keys to private companies that had experience managing residential properties and who could raise private capital. And it worked for a while. You know, the housing did improve, but the companies were given these 50-year contracts that provided for almost no oversight, no effective oversight by the military, and provided tenants with very few rights.
Who are these companies? And when we talk about private companies, are they private landlords that a lot of us would have heard of, or are these private equity firms? Do we know who's actually making money here?
The companies, you know, also run civilian real estate. They're probably familiar to many of our listeners. Lincoln Companies, Hunt Companies, Corvias, Balfour Beatty. They're some of the biggest landlords in the country.
What kind of money are we talking about here? What kind of money are these folks making?
Well, the problem is that the government won't say. How much money these companies are paid is a secret. We've been able to dig up a few clues, and we're talking about millions of dollars in revenues are flowing into each company each year. How many millions, we don't know, because the government says it's a secret, a trade secret.
Well, it's a trade secret, but people have to pay rent, right? Military families are paying rent to these companies and are also living in disgraceful conditions. I'm not sure what the military means by a trade secret, but that seems to be a disconnect here.
I agree. What we found was that the contracts gave a lot of autonomy to these private companies to run the housing. The contracts actually gave ownership of the houses in a long-term lease on the land to these companies. And military base officials had very little authority to intervene. So when military families would complain up the chain of command, there was little the chain of command could do to fix those conditions.
After your investigation, has the military responded?
The military responded immediately. As our stories began running, the military, each of the branches, sent out top commanders to every base in the country. And this has never happened on a story I've done before. They reported back that the problems were even worse than we had described. I think so far some 10,000 homes have been reported in need of safety repairs and upgrades. And the Senate has passed legislation, and there's legislation pending to give tenants more rights, to provide more oversight of companies, to penalize them financially if they don't fix these problems, and to allow local code enforcers on base. One of the things we found was that, you know, some of the basic tenant protections that civilians take for granted are not available to military families. We talked about Sharon, whose house was overrun by mice. If she was a civilian tenant, she could call the local housing inspector and the company could be fined and forced to clean it up. But they have no authority on military bases. Legislation that's pending right now would allow them to come onto bases and protect tenants.
What about the military families that are currently living in these conditions?
The fixes can't happen fast enough for the families living in these conditions. You know, we're talking about young children. These are young families that live on bases. They can't afford to move off base. It costs thousands of dollars to do so. And, you know, kids growing up with chronic respiratory problems can have long-term consequences.
Deborah Nelson is a freelance investigative reporter for Reuters and a journalism professor at the University of Maryland. Deborah, thanks so much for being with us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
We reached out to the Department of Defense, and a spokeswoman sent a statement acknowledging that, quote, there has been a lapse in overseeing implementation of DOD's housing privatization program. The statement also mentioned that the DOD is working on a tenant bill of rights as a first step on improving trust with military families. We also reached out to Lincoln for comment. They disputed the Lamone family's version of events with their mouse infestation. Lincoln also pointed to a survey that showed residents of their military housing rated the company's customer service as exceptional for the fifth year in a row. Find out more at thetakeaway.org. We're back on The Takeaway and glad you're with us on this Memorial Day. We're talking about the challenges that military families face, and many of you told us about the impact on children.
I'm an adult military brat, and I'd say the primary issue still is that families being separated for extended tours of duty.
I've been an Army wife for 20 years, and the one thing that has been certain our entire career has been the uncertainty.
Their entire world stops life as normal when I deploy.
Not a year has gone by that my husband hasn't missed one or multiple birthdays, anniversaries, or holidays.
People will only get so close because they're afraid that you're going to leave.
I grew up as a Navy brat. I wouldn't trade experiencing the world for anything, but I don't have any childhood friends. All my long-term friendships were formed after I struck out on my own.
Education is challenging for our children.
My husband had to go on to his next assignment without my son and I because we did not want to pull him out his senior year.
I feel that my children and I have served our country as well, albeit in a different way.
They didn't sign up for the life they were given.
We are your warriors. Our children will be your children's warriors.
Since 2001, more than 2 million American kids have had a parent deployed at least once. Studies show that while military children are resilient, when a parent is deployed, they can face higher rates of emotional and behavioral issues. Another reality of military life, regular moves, can also be disruptive for children. For more on how these situations impact children and military families, I sat down with Jamie Howard, a clinical psychologist at the Child Mind Institute who specializes in anxiety disorders and trauma resiliency.
Some of the common problems are emotional difficulties and behavioral difficulties. We see both more anxiety, a little more depression, and a little more acting out behaviors. Having a parent who is deployed is a stressor for kids. Many studies have shown this. So whenever families are under stress, the children are more at risk of having some mental health problems or just adjustment difficulties.
What should parents be looking for? How does anxiety manifest?
Yeah, anxiety manifests in lots of different ways. One is physiological symptoms. So they might have tummy aches in the little kids. They might have headaches. They might have muscle tension. They might have difficulty sleeping. Then there's the cognitive part of things, which is the thoughts they're having. So they might have a lot of intrusive thoughts about their parent being hurt if the parent is deployed, or worries about what's going to happen to the parent. And then there's also the behavioral component, which is avoidance. So ironically, sometimes a kid who really misses their parent might actually avoid talking to the parent or even try not to think about them because that's their way of trying to cope with the anxiety they're experiencing.
Okay, so I want to play you a cut from Katie Kirsch. Her husband is a pararescueman in the Air National Guard, and you're going to be hearing more from her later this hour. But first, let's take a listen to Katie talking about their two children who are 7 and 9 years old.
They don't quite understand the danger involved, which is good, but the older they get it. Like one of my husband's coworkers passed away from a parachuting accident. And so every time my husband goes to jump, you know, they think about it and they ask about his friend. And they have a lot more worries than I think the average child growing up.
In Katie's situation, how can parents explain to their children the danger of what their partner or their father or their mother is about to go through?
I always recommend that parents emphasize the parent's training and the skill involved. It's similar to a parent who is a firefighter or a police officer. Those kids can worry, too, when their parent goes to work. And so what we always want to emphasize is your mom or your dad really knows what they're doing. They spend a lot of time training for this. Or in the training scenario, there's a lot of safety precautions in place, and everyone really wants them to be safe and they're smart and know what they're doing.
We have to take a quick break, but we'll have more with clinical psychologist Jamie Howard in just a moment.
Hey, folks, I've got some news to share. We're coming up on 1 year that I've been hosting Politics with Amy Walter on The Takeaway, and we want to celebrate. That's right. We're going to broadcast from WNYC's The Green Space in New York City on Friday, May 31st at 9 a.m. Eastern Time. And the conversation will be all about the Electoral College. The event is free, but you need to reserve your tickets in advance. So visit thegreenspace.org/events to secure your seat. That's green, spelled G-R-E-E-N-E. We'll see you there.
This is The Takeaway with Tanzina Vega from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with WGBH Radio in Boston.
And we're back with Jamie Howard, a clinical psychologist at the Child Mind Institute. And we're talking about the ways children in military families are shaped by the things that come with a parent's service, like moving around a lot.
Relocation is really tough on kids, especially when it's frequent relocation. And when you have a parent in the military and you're moving to a new place where there aren't a lot of other military families around you, kids can feel somewhat isolated. We don't exactly live in a uniformly military culture. So people will make mistakes, well-meaning all the time, like they'll refer to a Marine as a soldier. And that just sort of exposes that they're not familiar, really, with military. And that can make kids feel more isolated. Then for older kids who do have greater prevalence of problems with their parents being deployed and with moving, they're leaving their friends. So that's really tough. Older kids really rely on their friendships.
We also, we asked Katie about the stability that she tries to maintain in her family. Let's take a listen to what she had to say.
They're always living in transition. You know, we live in a rented home, and they know that this isn't our forever home. They are constantly seeing friends come and go. They're constantly seeing my husband come and go.
How, it's a tough situation. What can parents do to help children deal with those feelings?
Yeah, as much as possible, if you can have routines, like no matter where we are, we eat dinner at 6 o'clock and we always have pizza on Fridays and we bring your favorite pajamas everywhere we go and we have the same pictures. So as much as you can have some of those consistent routines for kids, that will be helpful. For mom, though, she also needs some support. The research is pretty clear that kids whose non-deployed parent is significantly stressed out or anxious or depressed, those kids have a really hard time.
We know that post-traumatic stress disorder and traumatic brain injuries impact veterans, but how does that translate to their children?
For those kids, it's really confusing and overwhelming for them to see these invisible injuries, especially, you know, a TBI, post-traumatic stress disorder, it's hard to understand. They might just see that their dad is more angry or snaps more quickly, or just his personality seems different. Same case for moms. They won't necessarily develop PTSD from that because it doesn't technically count as a traumatic event for the child, but it certainly can cause an adjustment disorder, anxiety, stress, and sadness for the child.
There's a culture in the military, and that's probably similar to what we see in police culture, mm-hmm. which is also just being tough, toughing it out, you know, not showing a lot of emotion. Does that trickle down to kids in military families?
I think sometimes, for sure. If there's a family sort of ethos that we're brave, we're tough, which is true, and we don't seek mental health care, then that can be a problem for kids because they won't necessarily reach out to people who could be helpful, like their guidance counselor or some of their teachers. I think something that we really want to help the military community understand, and I think what we're getting somewhere with this is you can be brave and you can be tough and you can have post-traumatic stress disorder and you can get treatment for it, and it doesn't mean that there's any weakness there at all.
What are some of the positives? It's a tough conversation that we're having, but is there, you know, we talk a lot about resilience and grit. Are those things that also manifest in
children?
Yeah,
of course. So I remember one girl I worked with, her father was in the military. He was deployed to the Persian Gulf years ago, and he was also a firefighter. And she said, well, I know my dad's a hero, so that's what sort of helps me day to day when I know he's at work. And she's right. He's brave, and he is. Some people intentionally face dangerous situations in their life to help people. And so that's a really great thing to celebrate. And I see a lot of pride in a lot of military families. And some kids also really enjoy the travel, I would say. I've worked with some kids who've spent time in Italy and various places, and they thought of it as a really unique, exciting experience. And they don't necessarily have the predominant emotion of anxiety looming. They're more sort of you know, happy, well-adjusted kids.
Jamie Howard is a clinical psychologist at the Child Mind Institute. Thank you for joining us, Jamie.
Thank you.
We've been talking about the different challenges that military families face. And when we asked you, you talked about your children, the difficulties of moving or long deployments, but something else kept coming up again and again.
I remember when I was a military spouse, the hardest thing for me was finding a job.
The spouse's resumes don't realistically reflect their vast experiences.
I have a hard time getting hired because I am a spouse, and therefore when he moves, I move.
The one thing that the employers always asked me was, what if your husband has to transfer tomorrow?
I have a job now, and my husband is stationed 4 hours away, and I see him 3 days a week, and it shouldn't have to be that way.
The dependents are the unsung heroes that deserve so much more.
It's so hard. It really is.
That last voice you heard was
Carla Candelaria Oquendo. I live in Charleston, South Carolina. My husband's name is Romualdo Avila Taveras. He is an E6 nuclear electrician's mate, and I am an environmental health manager at the Medical University of South Carolina.
And you also heard from the husband of
Katie Kirsch. I live in the Silicon Valley, and my husband is in the Air Force. He's an E8, and he's a pararescueman for the Air National Guard. And I'm an executive assistant at an edtech startup company.
Carla and Katie both have full-time jobs, and that's no small feat, as one quarter of military spouses are unemployed and another 30% work part-time. And while both of them say their work is important, their current jobs are far different than what they had imagined for themselves.
What I thought I would be doing was working in the aerospace industry or possibly defense, as my goal ultimately is to promote space habitability and work on aerospace, space design.
I have a master's degree in history, and I saw myself going into teaching. It just wasn't feasible with my husband's schedule.
I talked to both Katie and Carla about the challenges they've faced in their own careers while their husbands have been in the military. For Carla, it started with working low-wage jobs while she finished her master's degree in human factors and engineering.
While I was doing my master's, I worked at the Publix deli, cutting meats and making subs. And that was after having my bachelor's degree. I worked as a paraprofessional in Duval County Public Schools in Florida, which basically I was reteaching children who did not speak English the lesson in their language and helping them transition into fully understanding the lessons in English.
And I'm curious, for both of you, you're not doing the thing that you thought you would be doing. So, Katie, I want to start with you here. How do you think the military approaches spouses' careers?
You know, I do think they recognize that it's very difficult for spouses to keep a full-time job with their many moves. There are networks available that women and men can try to help them, but it doesn't always translate. Businesses are looking for people with long histories of employment. They don't look upon, you know, skipping around jobs as a good thing, which is what military spouses have to do.
Carla, what about you? How do you feel the military approaches spouses' careers specifically?
Well, I think the intentions are there. I've definitely seen the evolution of the speech we get when we go to our spouse conferences and job fairs. But the resources and the actions are not meeting the words and the intentions. You know, we get these speeches about, well, just say you're a military wife, employers know, employers are here. But when we go to the job fairs, and I've gone to some that are spouse-oriented, some that are veteran-oriented, but spouses are welcome, you really see the dichotomy. You really see that spouses are being offered jobs as a barista at Starbucks or as a teller at a bank, but not the type of opportunities that can launch you into a long-term career.
And of course, there are other roles that both of you play. Katie, you are also a mom. You have children. Did that affect your career path while your husband was in the military or is in the military?
Absolutely. You know, most military spouses don't have their family near them. They're not able to help them. So especially living in the Bay Area where the cost of living is so high, the cost of childcare is very high. Where my husband is stationed is not like a full-fledged military base, so we don't have childcare on site. There was no way that I could afford childcare. So I had to stay home with the kids. I had to finish my master's degree. Even when I finished, it was still difficult to find a job that could balance the cost of childcare. And like I said, when I wanted to go into teaching, you know, to start out as an adjunct professor, to start fresh out the door, you know, you're going to get the classes that the tenured professors don't want. You're going to get the 8 a.m.s and the 6 p.m.s. And a military spouse with a deploying husband or wife needs basically a 9-to-5 job, because you're going to have months on end with no one to help you at night, no one to help you those early mornings. So I started my career much later in life than a lot of my friends who aren't military spouses.
I'm wondering if either one of you, when you became a military spouse, I mean, I'm sure you expected challenges, but did you expect challenges when it came to your career?
Absolutely not. You know, we talk so much, especially, you know, around election time, about how much we care about the military and we support military families. And so I expected challenges like the distance and, you know, maybe my husband having long hours or different hours. I expected moving to places. I knew that would be a thing, but I also expected a lot more help and maybe more flexibility. So I've been fortunate that my husband has been able to go to places where he's either close to me or close to industry, which is where he is now. And he has a group of coworkers, all of whom have the same qualifications, the same experience, but different aspirations. And the ones that want to stay get orders to leave, and the ones that want to leave get orders to stay. I don't think it's well thought out. I think the military is still living in the days of the right stuff, right? When we had our first aviators and our first astronauts, and the wives were, you know, this pretty picture, perfectly manicured, and they understand and see that we want something more, but they still sort of expect us to fit that mold. It's been a lot of challenges that I didn't expect in places where, honestly, it doesn't make sense to me. These should not be challenges. These should be easy fixes.
Katie, we learned about your story because your husband, Sean, called us when we asked for stories about the challenges that military families face, and I want to play his call.
My wife has finally found her dream job at a startup company at the very tail end of my 25-year military career. We can't afford to stay in the Bay Area, though. She's followed me and taken care of our two kids, ages 7 and 9, on top of her full-time job for months sometimes. Her only reward is having her spouse back home.
Katie, how did that call from Sean make you feel?
I'm emotional about it because the job I have now is definitely, I don't know if I'd say it's my dream job because I didn't dream of having this job, but now that I have the job I have, I love it. I love the people I work with. I love our mission. And it makes me sad to think that the reason why I can't continue is because of the cost of living of the area. Where we live now, our housing is subsidized and we can make it work right now, but I don't know what the future holds when my husband is retired. We won't be able to afford where we live. So I would be facing a really long commute or I don't know what. But I do know that I love the job I have. And you know, and I have followed my husband from day one for 12 years in his journey. And so part of me wants to say, well, I want to continue my journey. You know, it's my turn for you to follow me. But I have to think of, you know, what's good for our family. And, you know, we didn't put our time into the military for so long to come out of it and then struggle with affordable living.
What do you think the military could do better? What would you like for the military to do better to help you and other people who are in this situation right now?
honestly, money, because we are limited in what we can do. We are limited in what we can achieve. And I wish I could pay for those certifications. I wish I could not work a second job on top of everything. And finally, make the time somebody spends in a place a little longer, because 2 years is not enough to get a degree sometimes. 2 years is not enough to buy a house. 2 years is not enough to do a lot of things. So while our peers are investing their paycheck in the house that they bought, we are losing our housing allowance on properties that we cannot really grow or invest or depend on.
Is there anything that you would like to ask each other, or any advice you want to offer each other or other military spouses who may be going through this?
I think as military spouses, you need to make the best of the situation that you're in and make friends and build communities around you that will support you to be able to do the things you want to do. I got my amazing job through my neighbor, who is also a military wife. And I think if we all, you know, just still stick together and help each other, you know, we can live our best lives with what we have.
Yeah, I think the most important thing is to know, as a spouse, you are not alone, is the biggest thing we need to hear. And look for things outside of what you're told. Look for things out there. Look and ask and bother and ask and bother, but don't stop.
Carla Candelaria Oquendo and Katie Kirsch, thank you for being with me. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Tensina, for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
Carla is currently an environmental health manager at the Medical University of South Carolina, and Katie is an executive assistant at an educational technology company in Silicon Valley. We began the show today by speaking with Gold Star father Terry Burgess. He said he encourages families who have lost their loved ones more recently to share their stories. So we end today with a Gold Star widow who is trying to do just that. She lost her husband 21 months ago.
My name is Sherry Jennings Kivan. My husband was a flight engineer in the Marines in Marine Aviation. Sergeant Julian M. Kivan. The man was the most kindest man you would ever meet. No one ever had a bad word to say about him. I had never met anyone that was quite like him, and that's why I fell for him. He was so smart. He went to Michigan Tech on a full ride scholarship and still joined the Marines because that's who he was as a person. When we had gotten married, he flew a lot. I couldn't keep him on the ground for very long. He loved his job and he loved to fly and he loved to travel. He had found out on a Thursday that he was leaving on Monday, so he was a last minute pull to be on this plane as a crew. Routine flight training from Monday through Friday. And I said, you know, I really don't want you to go. And he said to me, honey, I've been in town for 3.5 weeks. It's time for me to go. The next morning, Monday, when he left, he pulled my car out of our garage. And I watched him put his suitcase in the back of my car, and I watched him drive off, and I gave him a kiss. I said, you know what, everything's going to be okay. And I don't know why I said that to him, but I did. Then at 2:30 a.m., I get a knock on the door from 4 men in uniform to inform me he was missing. And that was it. I'm not going to sugarcoat this. It has been a nightmare. It's like the ground underneath you opens and you keep falling into a black hole and there's no safety net. And it doesn't end because he should be here laughing with me. We should be here buying this house together. We should be here going through these steps as a husband and wife. We had promised each other forever. And you don't prepare for these things because this is not something that should happen. But I have to live with that every day. And I move forward every day the best I can. Tomorrow, I leave to Arlington National Cemetery to see my husband, and I'm excited. And I know that sounds so strange because he's not with me, but I feel closer to him when I'm near him in Arlington Cemetery because that's where he's at. And I know this is, I'm going to take this a step further and sound really silly, but I'm getting my hair and my nails done because I want to look good for my husband, because I did that when he would leave and come back from flying. Do I feel like people should be able to have their barbecues on Memorial Day? Absolutely. But I also think that people need to take a minute and recognize what it is for and why they're able to have that barbecue. And think of these men and women who have gone on and sacrificed their life for their freedom. So that way you can enjoy that barbecue and it'll be a celebration of life to them. I don't think my husband or any of other men and women that have gone on before us want us to be sad for the rest of our lives. No, they want us to have a good time because this is why they gave their life. It's for us to have these freedoms.
That was Gold Star widow Sherry Jennings Kivan. She spoke to us last week before she left Fort Worth for Washington, D.C. for the weekend. Thank you to TAPS, the Tragedy Assistance Program for Survivors, for connecting us with Sherry. Thanks so much for listening, and I want to give a special thanks to producer Isabel Angel for producing this hour today. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.